Hey, Robert.
Hey, Ryan.
So there's a lot of interesting economic news coming out, and a lot of the market's responding. Market is down over the last few weeks as a consequence. So there seems to be this paradox. On the one hand, it looks like unemployment is low, the U.S. economy is buzzing forward. There's a lot of construction of manufacturing plants. Subsidized by the government to a large extent. There's a lot of activity, and the economy seems to be growing and seems to be doing okay. But on the other hand, there seems to be a lot of pessimism, a lot of malaise, a lot of people who seem to be struggling. Interest rates are high, so it's difficult to buy a home. Mortgages are very expensive. It's car loans are expensive. So a lot, people interest rates on credit cards have gone through the roof. People are taking on a lot of debt in spite of this. The government, of course, has huge amounts of debt at this point. How do we reconcile? What does ingenuism, put it this way, what does ingenuism have to contribute to trying to reconcile kind of the contradictory signals that we're getting in the marketplace?
Well, I think that first of all, we need to acknowledge that if you go back 25 years, interest rates don't look high at all. They actually look quite low. But it's not 25 years ago. It's not the 90s. It's the 2020s. And we do have a different economy than we've had in a long time. The fact that it keeps chugging ahead is, what we started talking about here is the miracle of the 21st century is we're in a phenomena that's very difficult to stop. It's not impossible to stop, but it takes more than the normal level of mistakes that we're currently seeing. And that's in the United States. In other parts of the world, I think that actually ingenuism has been largely reined in, and we're seeing the impact of that in those countries. But sticking to the US at first, there's always a paradox when you are at this, I'll say, point in the cycle, although there is no cycle, there's no predictable, there's no constant amplitude or frequency or anything. But at this point, there's always a paradox of there's concern about a recession and the Fed is active. And so the concern is if the economy is too strong, the Fed will overshoot whatever is necessary on monetary policy to rein in inflation, and then the economy will crash, versus if the economy is, they call it the Goldilocks economy, not too hot, not too cold, it's just right, then the Fed can stop. It can have a long pause. They could start cutting rates if inflation continues to go down. And so you always get this weird paradox where the economy, the market, and sentiment seem to diverge at this point in the cycle. But I do think that the US economy has been shockingly robust since March of 2020, since COVID. I mean, we were really pleasantly surprised that COVID, while certain activities were, they screeched to a halt, mostly because they were forbidden, that most activity, the production of food, the production of entertainment, the production of basically all the necessities of life, even the toilet paper shortage was short-lived.
Production of Amazon.
Yes, that things just kept moving along despite this enormous upheaval. And today we have much smaller concerns than a global pandemic. And so it's not surprising to me that the economy has rebounded because we have this very strong tide to swim with, the fact that people are so connected. The fact that, at least in the private sector, there's been a real movement and adaptation of the kind of things that you've always seen at 3M or at Apple, of trying things and really evolving the things that work on a rapid basis. So the US economy has a lot going for it. Now, there are other aspects, and it may be that the economic growth right now and some of the sentiment is due to the fact that in the numbers, you count sort of all activity equally when what really matters is productive activity. And that's not guaranteed moment to moment, every project to project in people's individual lives or corporations' individual lives, but it is guaranteed over time because you have a very strong feedback mechanism in the market.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people don't appreciate about the economy is the role ingenuism plays and the importance it has in producing that which generates economic growth, which is really entrepreneurial activity, new businesses, or existing businesses discovering new ways of doing business and implementing those. And that kind of dynamism seems to be still alive and well in much of the tech industry and even in some of the other industries. You know, as long as there's some economic freedom and people, we haven't fundamentally changed the attitude towards failure yet. We haven't fundamentally changed the culture that is very entrepreneur driven and very experiment driven. The world is still connected. It's getting maybe a little less connected with things like China and everything, but it's still well connected. The drivers of economic growth, the ingenuism drivers of economic growth, are still alive and well.
Yes, and I don't think we should be complacent about that. Yeah. And there's certainly more that we could be doing, you know, from the top. But of course, we've started to talk more about the bottom up because that's really more consistent with ingenuism. But as people, you know, whatever you call it, but as people adopt this attitude towards progress of being connected with other people, of continuously learning, of taking feedback, recognizing failure as a lesson, and you know, trying again or trying something else, depending on what the feedback was, there's an awful lot of momentum in our daily lives and in our leading corporations and even our leading institutions. You know, unfortunately, that particular mindset does not seem to exist in Washington, D.C. on either side of the table. You know, we're seeing the potential for a government shutdown, which is, you know, all driven by politics and the need to create certain or desire to create certain appearances. And we have, you know, massive initiatives that don't show any of the characteristics of ingenuism, of starting with small investments to see what works, to learn, and then ramping up to larger investments once you have figured out what learns. Now, you know, what works. We seem to still be doing the old throw a bunch of money at it and then consider the problem solved, which means you build trains that don't work or that don't give you what you were actually looking for. And by the time you recognize that, you already spent $76 billion. And of course, you can't quit now. So you just keep throwing good money after bad. Yeah. And that's the most discouraging part about the US economy to me, is that at the more centralized levels, I don't see any evidence of ingenuism blossoming. You know, we had opportunities in COVID and some were fulfilled on, you know, the vaccine is our favorite example. But those are exactly what ingenuism calls for, is you make a lot of small investments, then you figure out quickly what's working, and then you ramp that up. And it, you know, it's overstating to say it saves the world, but it's not overstating a lot.
And of course, ideally at the federal level, what we'd like to see is just get out of the way and allow these kind of investments to be made. If they're good investments, the private sector is likely to make them. And you know, the biggest problem we probably face in America today are the barriers to engaging in productive activities, the regulatory barriers, the zoning barriers, the environmental barriers that seem to be a constraint rather than a plus. And what is coming out of Washington, as you said, big spending amounts on factories that nobody is really sure make any sense in the future. It's big amounts of money and big white elephants might be being built. There's the chip plants in Phoenix that TSMC keeps saying, we're building it, but we're not quite sure exactly who's going to work in it or what exactly it's going to be producing, because we don't know what the market's going to be like. But if you subsidize, we will build. And they're doing it. And I just read a story about a Ford mini plant that was going to make batteries, $3.5 billion. And they just stopped saying, And the article quotes Ford as saying, we're not sure we can productively manage this plant. So we're going to pause it for now, and we'll see if we ever resume it. Again, motivated primarily by the subsidies, by these big investments, rather than by, allowing Ingenuism to work. The private sector is very good at seeding little things and seeing what blossoms.
Now that so you're not wrong, in my opinion, and it's the easy answer because we know that feedback is strong in the private sector. It just is both a profit motivation and a failure punishment if a company does well or a company does poorly. I would like if there was more activity shifted and there were fewer top-down regulating, like that's all consistent with Ingenuism. What also would be consistent is to apply the principles to the large behemoth. That's never seems to happen on a regular basis, so it's easy to give up on it. And it's also easy to hand wave it. You get things like the entrepreneurial state where you just, sort of cherry pick the evidence or the stories to say, look, the government can be just as productive and just as ingenuous as a company can be. And it's not, but then you let them off the hook because you just say they can be. And if the top 10% of government projects, which wouldn't surprise me, are extremely productive, you have to focus on the other 90%. That's exactly what corporations do, either improving them or getting rid of them. And so I would be very excited if there were initiatives coming out of Washington that were taking a serious look at how we're going to try and accomplish these goals instead of just saying, okay, we've allocated $160 billion, check that box and move on. I'm not sure that would be any easier than getting, changing the general mindset of Washington, D.C., than having them give up power, but it very likely might be. And neither of that's going to happen out of this podcast episode. But
no, but there might be also something structurally in terms of incentives that makes this, at the very least, very, very difficult to do. And the reality is that it's not just American government that we're worried about, right? I mean, it's if we look at a global phenomena, there's just no governments that are very good at that. Maybe people point out Singapore, right, is maybe a place where they've done this successfully. But we're seeing the struggles the Chinese government is having right now with that economy and what is going on. And they are moving in a non-ingenuous direction of government solutions, big solutions, again, rather than kind of letting the market do what the beauty of Ingenuism is. The market does the Ingenuism thing, right? It does it organically. It if you just get out of the way, that's what actually happens.
Well, it's not. You consistently see across all sorts of different sort of organizations that the bigger the organization, the less ingenuous it tends to be. Both across sectionally and over time. And we also see counterexamples that suggest it doesn't have to be that way, but there's definitely some sort of force that drives things in that direction. And of course, the US economy is the biggest economy in the world. And so the US government is likely to be pretty damn uningenuous. And the Chinese economy is the second biggest economy in the world. And the same is what you would expect. Now, in China, though, there's sort of different mores and expectations such that, we've had this massive swing. Now, it's taken a decade, but we've had a massive swing from having a central government, so a top-down entity that is fairly supportive of Ingenuism, and it's wildly successful, to it no longer being supportive of Ingenuism, that is, solutions being dictated from above rather than being allowed to grow from below. And I'm not sure what changed. I mean, there was a time, and counter to your sort of blanket statement, there was a time where the Chinese government actually increased the amount of Ingenuism that was allowed in China. And even encouraged it to a degree, because it was so low when they started, to a degree that was arguably unprecedented without revolution. And it was wildly successful. And one of the lessons of Ingenuism would be you learn from that and you keep doing what works, but not a lot of countries seem to have learned. You know, they prefer to point to Singapore, which is basically the size of, I don't know, the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a
less.
It's not comparable to the entirety of the U.S. or the entirety of China. But we've had this swing, and now we're seeing, what do they say, the chickens come home to roost. And it's going to be very difficult without a counter swing, which seems to be, again, I don't know why it went one way or why it went the other. I think that's one of the most interesting questions of recent history. But we can see the impact on the Chinese economy.
Well, I mean, I think anyway, I mean, from my reading, which is limited, it seems like they were so poor, they needed to do something. And allowing for people to be entrepreneurial and to connect. I mean, they opened up under Mao. There was no connection, right? Not inside China, and certainly not outside. And suddenly they opened everything up and they allowed that until the people in power felt that that openness threatened their own power. And that's because their objective function is a little different than the objective function we assume under ingenuism. I thought one other aspect of the China, which I read yesterday, one of these real estate companies that is going bankrupt, that is really in trouble, they basically put the CEO in jail. Not under any claims of fraud or anything like that yet, but just for failing, basically. And of course, that is the exact opposite of the approach we advocate for, or ingenuism advocates for. But it is interesting how they deal with these kind of things in that culture. We're not yet at that point in the United States, luckily.
Yes, I'm sure there are dozens of politicians in Washington, D.C. who would love to put Elon Musk in jail, but they're not able to. And that is part of when we talk about a supportive environment. You know, we think of it as being more something that is intentional. You know, the way you describe it, and I'm not arguing with it because I don't know anything about it, but of China sort of stumbling in for lack of any other options to an ingenuous approach to progress, and then it being wildly successful to a point where, you know, there's today the US government has its own industrial policy, and it's doing it, in my opinion, terribly, not because of the particular choices or the areas they're investing in, although I have my own thoughts about that, but the way they're doing it is very top down, very bulky, not at all experimental. You know, it's if there is success, it will be luck. And so you can do that for a long time incrementally, and think you're not harming progress, even though you are, because you're, you know, moving growth from 4% to 2%, or in China from 10% to 6%. But at some point, the pendulum actually, it's like an inflection point where the lack of ingenuism starts to create observable problems, not just opportunity cost, but observable problems. And then, of course, the solutions are all top down. And while, you know, those can often mask problems for years, in the end, the, you know, economics wins out in the end. And it isn't something that's unique to the to governments. You know, it happened in the financial sector in the U.S., although there was a lot of government involvement in the 2000s up through 2008. But it is, in my opinion, it is only, there's only one way out for the Chinese economy, and it would require a complete reversal that, you know, might be politically impossible. But otherwise, this trend that we're seeing now is just going to get worse.
Yeah. And I worry, of course, about the U.S. trend, not only because of this industrial policy, but also, like the Chinese government, it seems like the U.S. is turning against its entrepreneurs or its very successful companies. We've seen over the last couple of weeks two big antitrust actions, once against Google and yesterday against Amazon. And you read the claims they make, and as from an economics perspective, put aside the legal whatever, it's just the claims are ludicrous, and yet they have a good chance in court.
I wonder, because it'll take a while. And both of them, the irony, of course, is, and the same thing happened with Microsoft in its big antitrust case, is that the things that the FTC is focused on are the things that have just become less relevant. AI is definitely has the potential to not just break Google's, I'll say it, virtual monopoly on search, not as a search offering, but in terms of what people use. Now, monopoly is in terms of offering. If you want to be, if you want to argue the economics of it, you have to say there are no other providers. But Google has massive market share, and AI potentially puts Google out of business. If no one needs to search in the same way that they historically have, what does Google have anymore? And the same thing with Amazon. Amazon finally has, you can order on Walmart, and it's basically the same experience as Amazon. And it has competitors coming from all directions. People who are going to sell for less but not provide fast delivery. People are going to sell for more but provide more personalized items, and of course, mass market with Walmart.
And AI is going to change that too. I mean, why even bother with Amazon if I can just tell my personal assistant, AI personal assistant, go buy me X and it will do the shopping, find me the best deal based on my parameters, delivery, personalized, whatever, in whatever store. You might expect fragmentation of retail with personal assist, AI personal assistants. Who knows? That's the beauty of experimentation.
Yes, and there are already services offering that you basically say, this is what I'm looking for. And there's a lot of shopping is browsing, and Amazon has advantages, and Amazon does a really good job. So I think they're less likely to disappear, but to argue that they're a monopolist is ludicrous. But then to argue it today, when whatever monopoly or market power is more accurate that they've ever had has certainly begun to diminish. It's
It reminds me of not so much a Microsoft case, but the IBM case where IBM dominated the mainframe. And by the time the court case wound its way through the court system, PCs were out and IBM mainframes were about to become irrelevant. And it seems like history repeats. All
yes.
right.
Governments involved, yes.
So we will talk next week. Thanks, Robert.
All right. Thanks, Ron.
Cool.